National Radio Club.
Welcome back to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for April 2014. This is a special edition for April of 2014. This is the third hour of the DX Audio Service. You know, we'd still like to get a better idea of who listens to our magazine on what format. Now, obviously, when we mail out CDs, we know who's listening to those CDs. But we'd like to hear from the folks at EDXN. A while back, we asked you to send us an email and just say, "I listen." And, well, we've gotten very little response. So we're wondering if we should even bother uploading the EDX Audio Service to EDXN. If you listen to this program on EDXN and download the MP3s, just tell us. Just send me an email and say, "I listen." That's all. You won't be added to a list. You won't be bothered anymore. Unless you ask us a question, in which case I'll answer it. But we just like to hear from you. My email address is fvobe, that's F-V-O-B-B-E, at realoldiesradio, all one word, .com. That's realoldiesradio.com. Please, send us an email and let us know you listen.
You won't believe how big TV still is. Staggering viewership numbers and dominant revenue figures by Sam Thielman, March 2nd, 2014. As the upfronts approach and the new fronts try again to imitate them, expect to hear a lot about the twilight of traditional television with the rise of digital video. But don't believe it. A new study from Nielsen reveals the depth and breadth of both universes, and comparative viewership numbers aren't even close. The study, conducted with ad targeting firm Simulmedia, contains plenty of insights, but among the most striking is the size of either industry. Nielsen rarely pulls back the veil on exactly how big the TV and video worlds are. They do mint the currency in the former, after all. But here it is in black and white. There are 283 million television viewers monthly. The population of the U.S. is 313 million. Each of those 283 million is watching an average of 146 hours of television. Compare that with 155 million online video viewers, averaging just shy of 6 hours monthly on mobile and almost 6.5 hours over the web. So while TV's audience is still almost twice that of digital video, the amount of money in digital isn't even 5% of the mammoth $74 billion chunk of change in television. What's going to bring about growth in the former, says Amit Seth, Nielsen's EVP Global Media Products, is equivalency. ABC already offers digital options for audience deficiency units, ADUs or make goods, and Fox said last year it would provide Hulu inventory for the same purpose. Neither network was able to provide current comment by press time. But Seth said he foresees greater porousness between digital video and TV. The company isn't just hoping for that. Nielsen's DPR product, which measures non-mobile streaming video, is set to finally launch in the spring after a delay. Nielsen also will be continuing to refine a tool that offers third-party data miners are already selling, purchaser data that gives a measurable return on investment to advertisers. He says, "We have access to 90-plus percent of credit card transactions anonymized through a third-party data provider. Do you shop home improvement? If so, do you shop at Home Depot or at Lowe's?" Nielsen now knows. Content producers like NBC Universal have pioneered similar initiatives, but it's impossible to overstate the importance of third-party measurement as the analytics world gets more complicated. Lest this sound like too much progress too quickly, Dave Morgan, founder and CEO of Simulmedia, says not to worry. Business as usual will probably continue apace for a while. The silos aren't coming down anytime soon, said Morgan. There's a Silicon Valley expectation that there will be a desiloization of TV imminently, and nobody who took part in these dinners and discussions, not even the most ardent online people, think that's the case. Morgan and Seth agree that the industry's best hope is in more granular data. The fuzzy intermedia metrics can lead to nothing but more debates at the ARF and the 4As and the NAB and forever, said Morgan. But what you can't argue about is what happened after they saw the ad. What happened at the cash register? And that piece, written in rather complex language and obviously intended for television management, is entitled, "You Won't Believe How Big TV Still Is." and it was written by Sam Thielman. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service.
Pay TV's Reform Gamemanship, Bad Play for Rural America by Jess Peterson, Executive Vice President of the U.S. Cattlemen's Association. U.S. ranchers, farmers, and residents across rural America depend on reliable and continual access to broadcast television news and programs. Access is critical to maintain connection with not only the greater international and national scope of news and information, but also local and regional news outlets. From weather and agricultural reports to major news and sports, local TV is at home on the range and on the farm. Members of the U.S. Cattlemen's Association value broadcast TV and support the efforts by local TV stations to receive fair compensation from the cable and satellite companies. The large cable and TV satellite companies maintain strong profit margins by packaging free local TV with cable programs and retransmitting it as a component of their paid-for-TV packages. Like any producer in the supply chain, it makes sense that these local TV stations be properly compensated for their services. Maintaining the retransmission consent provision secures funding for the local news and public affairs programming upon which so many of our rural citizens rely. Currently, cable packages across the country ensure viewers have access to local TV programming. However, Congress is contemplating legislation that could eliminate the current structure and provide a pathway for cable and satellite companies to remove this provision and instead force viewers to pay additional fees for local viewing access. Local TV connects America, plain and simple. Oftentimes, it's the sole communications infrastructure connecting rural and urban communities. High-speed broadband and wireless cell phone coverage is still very limited in rural America. Local TV remains a steady, easy, and accessible source for agriculture news, markets, and emergency communications regarding fires, flood, and weather. Peterson, the author of this commentary, is a fifth-generation Montana rancher and knows it's essential that his family and fellow ranchers and farmers across the country continue to have access to up-to-the-minute local weather alerts and emergency information as provided through broadcast television. This affects both the bottom line and safety. From cattle producers to broadcast TV producers, congressional action that undercuts the value of the production chain is never the right course of action. Simply put, profits for the cable company should not take precedence over free access to local programming, emergency alerts, and weather warnings, which should remain outlets available to all, whether they receive it via free over-the-air broadcast TV or a pay TV service on the basic tier. Peterson is Executive Vice President of the U.S. Cattlemen's Association. From Dallas, Texas, I'm Wally Warro for the DX Audio Service.
FCC agents trace radio interference to doorbells, video games, and blankets. When signals interfere with cell towers or radio broadcasts, agents crack down. This story is from Thomas Greita in the Wall Street Journal from March 11th of 2014. A federal agent who shows up unannounced at a building along a Texas highway might be looking for any number of things. Illicit drugs or immigration violations, say, or illegal firearms, or fluorescent lights, which was what the agent had in mind when he walked into the Perfect Cut Salon in San Antonio last July. The lights were violating communications regulations. The agent had used signal tracking equipment to home in on the offenders and told the owner, Ronald Bethany, that his lights emitted radio signals that interfered with a AT&T cell phone tower. That violated Federal Communications Commission rules protecting airwaves licensed to AT&T, the agency determined. Mr. Bethany did not have a license to operate on that frequency, the agent told him, so his fixtures need to go. I told them, okay, but who's going to pay for this? Mr. Bethany says. I've got to use the lights. Interference can be a serious business. In 2010, hedge fund mogul Philip Falcone's wireless venture LightSquared Incorporated filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy after the Federal Communications Commission determined that it would interfere with GPS signals. The mixed signals aren't always so weighty. In recent years, the Federal Communications Commission has issued warning letters directing people to stop operating cordless phones, television sets, and wireless cameras. Last June, a Federal Communications Commission letter to a Springfield, Oregon address warned that harmful interference had been traced to the property, and that the property operator may have to cease operation of the device, possibly a bad doorbell transformer. That 2013 letter lists other common culprits, including aquarium heaters. Similar letters went out in 2012, went to several operators of video game consoles. This unresolved problem, the letter typically warns, could result in a monetary forfeiture. The Federal Communications Commission can demand fines of up to $16,000 a day, or $112,500 an incident, from people who aren't FCC licensed. Offenders usually rectify the problems, the FCC says, often working them out with whomever is complaining. Managing the radio spectrum has been part of our core mission since the inception of the FCC in 1934, says Julius Knapp, head of the agency's Office of Engineering and Technology. Most anything electrical can violate. Incidental radiators, in FCC lingo, are devices like electrical motors that aren't built to generate any radio frequencies, but do anyways. Unintentional radiators are designed to generate signals with devices like computers, but aren't supposed to broadcast. Intentional radiators, like cordless phones, can transgress when they transmit outside intended frequencies. Agents arrived at Shelton's Auto Lube and Auto Wash in Fortuna, California in 2008, looking for signals disrupting AM broadcasts. They traced them to Shelton's car wash equipment. "I didn't know anyone was listening to AM anymore," says Odell Sheldon. The FCC told him a driver complained about car radio reception. It took a few days to find and fix the problem. The government doesn't much care why interference happens. To the Federal Communications Commission, noise is noise. In a 2013 letter, the FCC wrote to the owner of a plasma TV set after a ham radio operator complained to the agency of interference. "Continued operation of the television," warned the letter, from which the TV owner's identification is redacted, "is not legal under FCC rules." It doesn't matter how far bad signals extend. The Federal Communications Commission pressed Perfect Fit Industries into a consent decree in which the Charlotte, North Carolina bedmaker agreed to develop a compliance plan and pay a $7,000 fine in 2005 after some of its electric blankets caused interference, FCC documents show. Perfect Fit didn't respond to inquiries. "Just because it doesn't go very far," says the FCC's Mr. Knapp, "doesn't mean that we don't need to fix it." Ham radio operators are frequent sources of complaints. A 2012 FCC letter told a Pomona Park, Florida resident to stop using a well pump that conflicted with amateur radio frequencies. A 2009 letter warned Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary of Woodstock, New York, that its electric fence was causing interference for a ham radio operator and noted it has been warned before. "We didn't want our rambunctious, dark-colored 2,000-pound steers pushing down the fence, wandering onto adjacent state roads and causing a deadly accident," says Sanctuary co-founder Doug Abel. "Right next door, our ham radio-loving neighbor has a 60-foot-high antenna that would allegedly pick up a clicking sound from our fence. He installed hardware to dampen the signal." Private signal sleuths, too, hunt down erratic emissions. J. Jacob Meyer, president of Wireless Engineering Consultants, Perkel Communications Company, investigates interference at 150 to 200 cell sites a year, mostly for wireless clients. His team last November faced a puzzling signal in San Diego that would pop up, disappear for weeks, then resume. Using directional equipment, it identified a cordless phone on a yacht that occasionally was visited. Mr. Jacob Meyer said the skipper agreed not to use the system in port. Radio hobbyist Tom Thompson of Boulder, Colorado, last year tracked down a signal using a homemade contraption. After knocking on the suspect's door, he traced it to ballast on a marijuana grow room light. He says he built a filter, and now the grower agrees to use it. Ballasts are frequent offenders. Makers of the components, which regulate electricity to bulbs, test them for FCC compliance. Some interfere anyway. Ballasts earned Brookfield Office Properties Incorporated, the real estate company, a citation last month at one of its Los Angeles buildings where lights were interfering with a Verizon Communications Incorporated cell site. The FCC had warned Brookfield in May, asking for progress reports, but received none, the new letter said. It warned of fines and a possible equipment seizure or jail time. A spokesman for Brookfield says it tries to resolve issues regarding its properties, but doesn't comment on regulatory issues. The lights at Perfect Cuts in San Antonio came from the General Electric Company, which in 2011 found some of its ballasts cause interference, a spokesman said. GE has offered to replace those ballasts free of charge. Mr. Bethany says he initially declined GE's offer, but when the FCC letter, after the agent's visit mentioning a possible $16,000 a day fine, he swapped out those ballasts. He still doesn't see why he needed to, given that his 18-year-old shop predates the cell tower. Hey, I was here first. This has been FCC Agents Trace Radio Interference to Doorbells, Video Games, and Blankets, written by Thomas Greita in the Wall Street Journal. You can contact Thomas at thomas.greita, G-R-Y-T-A, at WSJ.com.
AM needs strong medicine to survive. This article comes to us from Leslie Stimson in Radio World Magazine, March 7th, 2014. This is one in a series summarizing notable comments being filed to the FCC on its AM revitalization NPRM. Read other summaries at radioworld.com/AM comments. The National Alliance of AM Broadcasters is a new group composed mostly of AM owners and formed to support the revitalization of stations on the senior band. Led by Radio Techniques consulting engineer Edward Schober, members include Radio Techniques, Multicultural Radio Broadcasters, Legacy Media Memphis, Enrico Broncadora, Winchester Radio Broadcasters, and Bill Paris, owner of Maryland-based Radio Broadcast Communications. The NAAMB supports many of the FCC's proposed initiatives to help AM, but believes several of the implementation details will be counterproductive. Overall, what the Commission has put forth in its notice of proposed rulemaking is grossly inadequate to help AM, according to the group and its comments filed with the Commission. AM needs strong medicine to survive, says the group, adding that half measures will only serve to extend a languishing demise of the medium. Many reforms, like an AM-only FM translator application window, can be put in place immediately, according to the group. The NAAMB also agrees with Dutrail, London, and Rackley that principal community service is an anachronism in the present media environment, and that daytime-nighttime community coverage standards should be eliminated or, at the very least, modified. The group also believes in eliminating the so-called ratchet rule that says AM antenna efficiency standards should be modified. No new analog AM stations should be authorized. There's too many on the band now, asserts NAAMB. Only applications for digital AM should be authorized going forward, but not those transmitting in IBOC, notes the group, which terms that technology a complete disaster. That's because even with ideal equipment integration and tuning, AM IBOC serves only a small fraction of the analog AM service area, and stations with troublesome directional antennas cannot be equalized for satisfactory performance. NAAMB says AM IBOC hybrid transmissions should be discontinued. Alternatives like MA3, MA4, or Digital Radio Mondial DRM30 systems are needed for a successfully AM digital transmission, according to NAAMB. The group also believes the FCC should amend Part 15 and Part 18 of its rules to better protect AM frequencies and provide a mechanism to identify noncompliant devices and installations. Part 15 exempts many in-car devices, notes the group. There are many times when the noise from an 18-wheeler will blank out an AM station for 100 yards or more. This is problematic if a listener is traveling in the same direction as the truck. The NAAMB proposes the commission use a web-based reporting system for users to report devices that appear to violate Part 15 and Part 18, as well as installations that generate excessive noise. Some ideas, like controversial reforms, require additional research and comment. The commission should establish a continuing notice of proposed rulemaking for these issues to develop a better record, says NAAMB, which tells the commission the NAAMB proposals are meant to help the FCC accomplish the goal of returning AM to its former vitality.
The iPod of Prison by Joshua Hunt. This article appeared in the New York Times. In early 2005, Josh DeMitt arrived at a federal prison camp in Sheridan, Oregon, to serve a 30-month sentence for starting a fire outside an animal testing facility at Brigham Young University. The 19-year-old received a warm welcome from his fellow inmates, who greeted him with coffee and cigarettes, advice on procuring vegan meals, and a pocket AM/FM radio. The radio provided hours of welcome distraction for DeMitt, who had come from Sheridan's adjoining detention center, where, he says, he spent weeks without a radio while confined to a small cell for at least 23 hours a day. The radio was unlike any DeMitt had seen outside prison, with a transparent plastic body that revealed the landscape within. A single AA battery rested at the bottom of its circuit board, while its antenna, 1 3/4 inches of copper wire coiled around a small ferrite bar, peeked through a white Sony logo just above the AM/FM dial. The pocket analog radio, known by the bland model number SRF-39FP, is a Sony ultralight model manufactured for prisons. Its clear housing is meant to prevent inmates from using it to smuggle contraband. And at under $30, it is the most affordable Sony radio on the prison market. That market consists of commissaries, which were established by the Department of Justice in 1930 to provide prisoners with items not supplied by their institutions. By offering a selection of shampoos and soaps, they shifted personal hygiene costs to inmates. More than 500,000 inmates each week shop at commissaries stocked by the Keefe Group, a privately held company that sells items to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and 12 out of 14 privately managed state departments of corrections. A sample commissary order form lists items like an IBM typewriter ribbon, hair dye, RC Cola, Sensodyne toothpaste, chili garlic sauce, Koss CL-20 headphones, and a Sony radio. commissaries often carry other bargain brand radios. But according to former inmates and employees of the Bureau of Prisons and the Keefe Group, who spoke on the condition of anonymity, America's federal prisoners are most likely to own a Sony. Melissa Dolan, a Sony spokesperson, confirmed in an email that selling portable radios in American prisons has long been a stable business that represents sizable sales for the company. Of the models available, the SRF-39FP remains an undisputed classic, still found on commissary lists an impressive 15 years after its initial release, making it nearly as common behind prison walls as Apple's iPod once was outside of them. Despite competition from newer devices, like digital radios and MP3 players. But sheer availability doesn't explain its ubiquity. The SRF-39FP is the gold standard among prison radios in part because it runs on a single AA battery and offers 40 hours of listening time, longer than an iPod Classic. Digital models can require twice as many batteries, like the Sony SRF-M35FP, which runs on two AAAs. Federal inmates are particularly attuned to battery life because they are allowed to spend just $320 each month on commissary goods. More cash spent on batteries means less for snacks, stationery, clothing, and toiletries. The importance of radio battery life in prison communities cannot be overstated. The devices are relied on for more than listening to music, hearing about local news and weather, and watching television. TV sets in common areas often use transmitters to broadcast sound on a dedicated frequency. A study conducted at San Vittore Prison in Milan, Italy, found that in a place where privacy is constantly denied, radio becomes a vital tool for building and maintaining one's private self. Some inmates even had a term for using their radio to create a bubble of personal space. "I headphone myself," one said. There is also a bit of prison culture itself at work in the story of the SRF-39FP. Radios like the one that was loaned to DeMitt are usually left behind by inmates who have re-entered the free world. Some prisoners believe that it is bad luck for radios to leave prison with their owners, while others believe that taking them simply violates the convict code. According to former inmates like DeMitt and Stephen Grayson, author of The Unauthorized Federal Prison Manual, whether radios are abandoned as a matter of solidarity, convenience, or good karma, they pass from inmate to inmate, serving one sentence after another. The durable, analog SRF-39FPs have been changing hands in this manner for a decade and a half, which adds up to a lot of radios in circulation. This practice helps explain the relative rarity of the SRF-39FP outside prisons. A unit in good condition can fetch up to double or triple its retail value among enthusiasts and collectors, like Gary DeBach, a co-founder of the Ultralight Radio Group. According to DeBach, the outside supply depends upon stock siphoned from the California prison system and sold on auction sites like eBay. DeBach is a member of the DXing community, whose hobbyists attempt to pick up distant radio or television signals, including those from amateur or pirate radio stations. DX is shorthand for distant stations. DeBach's fascination with the SRF-39FP began when he realized that it could receive AM signals from places as distant as Japan and Korea at his home in Puyallup, Washington. "Since then, I've probably had more exposure to the SRF-39FP than anyone else who has managed to stay out of prison," DeBach said. Others in the online DXing community argue that the SRF-39FP is superior to virtually every other pocket analog radio, praising it for its large tuning thumb wheel, overall sensitivity and audio quality, and above all, its reputed indestructibility. Electronics and radio collectors also marvel at features that are normally associated with professional equipment rather than consumer goods, in particular an exceptional single integrated circuit receiver that ensures reception in remote locations or deep within heavy prison walls. In fact, the SRF-39FP was one of the first radios to use the breakthrough CXA1129N integrated circuit chip, considered by Debock to be the primary innovation among Sony pocket radios. It helped make the SRF-39FP the smallest and most sophisticated in a line of pocket radios that had launched two decades earlier, in the late 1970s. In recent years, Sony has opted to shift its prison radio lineup away from analog, focusing instead on digital models like the SRF-M35FP. Last year, the Bureau of Prisons decided that it was time to further upgrade prison tech. Following a successful test at the same West Virginia federal prison camp, where Martha Stewart spent 5 months for lying about a stock sale, prison officials began selling MP3 players that allow inmates to download songs at terminals in prison commissaries. A Bureau of Prisons spokesperson said that the MP3 program wasn't expected to make money in its early years. Price is one reason. The MP3 player sold in federal prisons cost roughly 3 times as much as an SRF-39FP, and downloads can cost up to $1.55 per song. Limited song selection is another reason. The Bureau of Prisons prohibits songs deemed explicit or likely to incite the inmate population. JPay, a company that provides services to inmates, boasts that, with its catalog of 10 million songs, no other music service in corrections offers as many tracks for download. However, despite modest expectations for the technology upgrade, the Bureau of Prison spokesperson Ed Ross said that more than 50% of federal inmates have already bought MP3 players. It seems inevitable that the MP3 player will soon completely eclipse radios like the SRF-39FP in American prisons, just as they did outside. But for now, both devices are woven into prison life. Josh DeMitt left his Oregon prison camp in May 2007, 2.5 years after he had arrived. While his radio didn't come back with him to suburban Utah, within a matter of weeks, he bought his first iPod. Joshua Hunt is a freelance journalist who has reported on business, technology, and sports in Japan for the New York Times.
Radio Shack to close 1,100 stores posts fourth quarter loss by Ellen Wolf. Radio Shack plans to close upward of one quarter of its store base amid deepening losses. The chain reported a net loss of $191 million in the fourth quarter, ending December 31st, compared with a year-ago loss of $63 million. Net loss for the full year hit $400 million, compared to $139 million in 2012. Net sales for the critical fourth quarter holiday period declined 20% to $935 million, and comp sales sank 19% on weak traffic and soft mobile performance, the company said. For the full year, net sales fell 10% to $3.4 billion and comps declined nearly 9%. In a statement, CEO Joe Manaka attributed the company's fourth quarter results to lower store traffic, intense promotional activity, particularly in consumer electronics, a very soft mobility marketplace, and a few operational issues. He said the decision to close up to 1,100 underperforming locations followed a comprehensive review of its store base over the last few months that considered location, area demographics, lease life, and financial performance. The consolidation, which is subject to the consent of Radio Shack's lenders, would still leave the chain with a strong presence in each market and more than 4,000 stores, including some 900 dealer franchise locations, he said. The company currently operates about 4,300 corporate-owned stores. Going forward, the chain will continue its turnaround strategy of repositioning the brand, revamping the product assortment, improving operational efficiency and financial flexibility, and updating its stores along a new concept model that has shown strong sales growth. In a research note, Janie Montgomery Scott retail analyst David Strasser lauded Menaka and his new management team for their valiant efforts, but suggested that the company could now follow the fate of Circuit City, which was also plagued by lost market share and a broader economic malaise. Compounding the problem, he said, is Radio Shack's overdependence on the maturing wireless business, its declining gross profits, and a liquidity squeeze from the store closures. The article, Radio Shack to Close 1,100 Stores, Post Fourth Quarter Loss, was written by Alan Wolf. I'm Wally Warrow in Dallas, Texas, for the DX Audio Service.
National Public Radio's All Things Considered announced that the Post Office has begun a new portable zip codes program. This program, inspired by an FCC ruling that allowed phone users to take their phone number with them when they moved, would allow people to also take their zip code with them when they moved, no matter where they moved to. It was hoped that with this new program, zip codes would come to symbolize a citizen's place in the demographic rather than geographic landscape. Assistant Postmaster General Lester Crandall was quoted as saying, he says, every year, millions of Americans are on the go, people who must relocate for work or other reasons. Those people may have been quite attached to their original homes or an adopted town or city of residence. For them, this innovative measure will serve as an umbilical cord to the place they love best. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service.
Until I listened to the Musings to the Members column and heard Tom Dimeo talk about some past April fools that we did, it never occurred to me that April 1st was coming up. And here we didn't even attempt to fool you. Or did we? Well, to keep on with the tradition of excellence here, I'd like to tell you about a few April Fool's hoaxes which have been done on radio. This article comes from Mark Fisher, who is a staff writer for The Washington Post. In 1992, National Public Radio's Talk of the Nation program announced that Richard Nixon, in a surprise move, was running for president again. His campaign slogan was, "I didn't do anything wrong, and I won't do it again." Accompanying this announcement were audio clips of Nixon delivering his candidacy speech. Oh, and did the listeners respond to this announcement, flooding the show with calls expressing shock and outrage. Only during the second half of the show did the host, John Hockenberry, reveal that the announcement was a practical joke. Nixon's voice was impersonated by comedian Rich Little. In 1949, Phil Schoen, a disc jockey for New Zealand radio station 1ZB, announced to his listeners that a mile-wide wasp swarm was headed toward Auckland. He urged them to take a variety of steps to protect themselves and their homes from the winged menace. For example, he suggested that they wear socks up over their trousers when they left for work, and that they leave honey-smeared traps outside of their door. Hundreds of people dutifully heeded this advice, until he finally admitted that it's all been a practical joke. The New Zealand Broadcasting Service was not amused by Schoen's prank. Its director, Professor James Shelley, denounced the hoax on the grounds that it undermined the rules of proper broadcasting. From then on, a memo was sent out to each station before April Fool's Day, reminding New Zealand radio stations of their obligation to report the truth, and nothing but the truth. In 1979, London's Capital Radio announced that Operation Parallax would soon go into effect. This was a government plan to resynchronize the British calendar with the rest of the world. It was explained that ever since 1945, Britain has gradually become 48 hours instead of all the other countries because of the constant switching back and forth from British summer time, the equivalent of our daylight savings time. To remedy this situation, the British government had decided to cancel April 5th and 12th of that year. Capital Radio received numerous calls as a result of the announcement. One employer wanted to know if she had to pay her employees for the missing days. In 1993, Dave Rickards, a DJ at KGB-FM in San Diego, announced that the Space Shuttle Discovery had been diverted from Edwards Air Force Base and would instead be landing at Montgomery Field, a small airport located in the middle of a residential area just outside of San Diego. Thousands of commuters immediately headed toward the landing site, causing enormous traffic jams that lasted for hours. Police eventually had to be called in to clear the traffic. People arrived at the airport armed with cameras, camcorders, and even folding chairs. Reportedly, the crowd swelled to over 1,000 people. Of course, the shuttle never landed. In fact, the Montgomery Field Airport would have been far too small for the shuttle to even consider landing there. Moreover, there wasn't even a shuttle in orbit at the time. The police were not amused by the prank. They announced that they would be billing the radio station for the cost of forcing officers to direct traffic. In 2001, Michael Enright, host of the Sunday edition of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's radio program This Morning, interviewed former President Jimmy Carter on the air. The interview concerned Canada's heavily subsidized softwood lumber industry, about which Carter had recently written an editorial piece in the New York Times. The interview took a turn for the worse when Enright began telling Carter to speed up his answers. Then Enright asks, "I think the question on everyone's mind is, how did such a washed-up peanut farmer from Hicksville, such as yourself, get involved in such a sophisticated bilateral trade agreement?" Carter seemed stunned by the insult. Finally, he replied, "Excuse me? A washed-up peanut farmer? You're the one to talk, sir. Didn't you used to be on the air 5 times a week? The tone of the interview did not improve from there. Carter ended up calling Enright a rude person before he hung up. Enright then revealed that the interview had been faked. The Toronto comedian Ray Landry had begun impersonating Carter's voice. The interview generated a number of angry calls from listeners who didn't find that joke anywhere funny. But the next day, the controversy reached even larger proportions when the Globe and Mail reported the interview as fact on their front pages. In 1973, BBC Radio broadcast an interview with an elderly academic, Dr. Clothier, who discoursed on the government's efforts to stop the spread of Dutch elm disease. Dr. Clothier described some startling discoveries that had been made about tree disease. For instance, he referred to the research of Dr. Emily Lang of the London School of Pathological and Environmental Medicine. Dr. Lang had apparently found that exposure to Dutch elm disease immunized people to the common cold. Unfortunately, there was a side effect. Exposure to the disease could cause red hair to turn yellow and eventually fall out. This was attributed to the similarity between the blood count of redheads and the soil conditions in which affected trees grew. Therefore, redheads were advised to stay away from forests in the unforeseeable future. Dr. Clothier was in reality a comedian by the name of Spike Milligan. In 1959, as Hawaii was being admitted into the Union as the 50th state, a Hawaiian radio station announced that Congress had passed an amendment to the statehood bill, refunding all federal income taxes that the Pacific Islanders had paid during the previous year. Thousands of people believed the announcement, and the backlash when they realized that, and there was backlash when they realized that there was no refund coming their way. In 1999, the Today program on BBC Radio 4 announced that the British national anthem, God Save the Queen, was to be replaced by a Euro anthem sung in German. The new anthem, which Today played for their listeners, used extracts from Beethoven's music and was sung by pupils of a German school in London. Reportedly, Prince Charles' office telephoned Radio 4 to ask them for a copy of the new anthem. St. James Palace later insisted that it had been playing along with the prank and had never been taken in. In 1993, Westdeutsche Rundfunk, a German radio station, announced that officials in Cologne had just passed an unusual new city regulation. Joggers going through the park would be required to pace themselves to no faster than 6 miles an hour. Any faster, it was felt, would unnecessarily disturb the squirrels who were in the middle of their mating season. In 1999, a Canadian radio station, in conjunction with Warner Music and Universal Music Group, informed its listeners that the arrival of Y2K would render all CD players unusable to read music discs created before the year 2000. Luckily, the DJ said, there is a solution. Hologram stickers were available that would enable CD players to read the old formats. These stickers would be sold for approximately $2 apiece. Furious listeners, outraged at the thought of having to pay another $2 for the stickers, immediately jammed the phones of both the radio station and the record companies, demanding that the stickers be given away for free. They continued to call, even after the radio station revealed the announcement was a hoax. In 1994, National Public Radio's All Things Considered program reported that companies such as Pepsi were sponsoring teenagers to tattoo their ears with corporate logos. In return for branding themselves with the corporate symbol, the teenagers would receive a lifetime 10% discount on that company's products. Teenagers were said to be responding enthusiastically to the deal. So, who was the joke on? In 1998, hundreds showed up in a Baltimore inner harbor hoping to receive some free gold. They heard on WQSR's morning show that a box full of gold coins had been found hidden inside the decking of an old sailing vessel, the Constellation, which was on display at the harbor. After using some of the gold to pay the repairs of the ship, the management of the Constellation Restoration Committee had decided to give away the rest to Maryland residents. Anyone showing up with a valid Maryland driver's license would be given a free gold coin. And show up they did. Many miles driving to get there, and paying to park in the harbor, the addition, of course. In fact, the Constellation Restoration Committee hasn't existed for over 20 years. On March 31, 1940, the Franklin Institute issued a press release stating that the world would end the next day. The release was picked up by radio station KYW, which broadcast the following message. Your worst fears that the world will come to an end are confirmed by astronomers of the Franklin Institute, Philadelphia. Scientists predict that the world will end at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tomorrow. This is no April Fool's joke. Confirmation can be obtained from Wagner Schlesinger, director of the FLEDS Planetarium of the city. Well, the public reaction was immediate. Local authorities were flooded with frantic calls. The panic only subsided after the Franklin Institute assured people that it had made no such prediction. The prankster responsible for the press release turned out to be William Castellini, the Institute's press agent. He had intended to use the fake release to publicize an April 1st lecture at the Institute titled, How Will the World End? Soon afterwards, the Institute dismissed Castellini. In 1987, a Los Angeles disc jockey announced that on April 8th, the Los Angeles highway system would be shut down for repairs for an entire month. This was alarming news in L.A., where it's necessary to use the highway to get almost anywhere. The radio station immediately received hundreds of frantic calls in response to the announcement, and the California Highway Patrol reported that they were also flooded with calls throughout the day. The station later admitted that it was stunned by the intensity of the public reaction to the hoax. A representative from the California Department of Transportation called the station's managers to share their opinion of the prank. Reportedly, they didn't think it was very funny. Carolyn Fox, a disc jockey for WHJY in Providence, Rhode Island, announced in 1986 that the Providence Labor Action Relations Board Committee had decided to close the city for the day. She gave out a number for listeners to call for more information. The number was that of a rival station, WPRO AM. Reportedly, hundreds of people called WPRO, as well as City Hall and the police. Even more people called into their offices to see if they had to go to work. WHJY's management later explained that it had never imagined a joke would have such a dramatic impact on the city. In 1977, the BBC gave airtime to Tom Jackson, General Secretary of the British Union of the Post Office Workers. Mr. Jackson was up in arms about a recent proposal that the British adopt a German method of addressing envelopes, in which the house number is written after the name of the road, and not before. In other words, instead of 10 Downing Street, it would be Downing Street 10. Jackson spoke at great length about the enormous burden this change would place upon the postal employees, insisting that postal workers would be furious because it would turn upside down the way we have learned to sort. His comments elicited an immediate reaction from the audience, many of whom phoned up to voice their support for Jackson's campaign. What the audience didn't realize was that there was no plans to change the way the British address their mail. Mr. Jackson's diatribe was an elaborate April Fool's Day joke. And in the category of really bad fake death reports is one we must make note of. In 1998, when Boston DJs Opie and Anthony announced that the mayor of Boston, Tom Molino, had died in a car crash. Because City Hall couldn't immediately reach the mayor to confirm that he was actually alive, many believed the report, including members of the mayor's family. The next day, Opie and Anthony were suspended without pay. In 1999, DJs at Oregon radio station KSJJ announced that the Ochoco Dam had burst, threatening downstream areas with massive flooding. What made the warning believable was that hundreds of houses in that area had been damaged the previous year when the Ochoco Creek had flooded. So terrified homeowners who heard the news, they quickly prepared to flee. Later, the DJs informed their listeners that it was all a joke. They had been having a little fun. And the homeowners were not amused. And finally, in the same genre of non-funny disaster warnings, there's also WNOR's 1992 April 1st report, in which it was warned that a large buildup of methane gas was about to cause a fiery explosion at Mount Trashmore, a landfill near Virginia Beach. Residents were warned to evacuate the area, causing the local 911 to be flooded with calls. The DJs responsible for the prank were suspended without pay for 2 weeks. And there's just a few of the April Fool's pranks which have been pulled on people in the last couple of years by radio folks. Well, it's time for us to go here on the DX Audio Service.
It's your time to go!
And that puts the wrap on this edition of the DX Audio Service for April 2014. We hope that you've enjoyed this special edition of the DX Audio Service, a little extra time we thought we'd throw in for the 29th anniversary. I'd like to thank you sincerely, those of you who have called, written emails, wrote letters, as well as just sent me an email that says, I listen. Seriously, it means a lot to us when we hear your comments and hear your praise and tell us how much you enjoy the DX Audio Service. And we look to be around at least another year or so. So why not tell us how you feel about the DX Audio Service? Drop us a card, letter, email, just say, I listen. That's all it takes. From Dave Alpert, Mark Durenberger, Phil Wayne, Chris Gay, Wally Walrow, and all of us here at the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service, I'm Fred Vobey, wishing you a happy spring and good listening. Remember, get out and support your radio club, and support radio.